Welcome to the Ecclesiastical History Society podcast. The EHS exists to explore all aspects and all periods of the history of Christianity. And in our podcasts, we welcome guests to discuss a wide range of topics. If you want to know more about the EHS, then visit our website, ecclesiasticalhistorysociety.com, or our social media pages.
Thank you for joining us for this EHS podcast episode. I'm your host, Angela Platt, a PhD student at Royal Holloway, who is currently investigating how love is valued and experienced in religious families of old dissenters in the 18th and 19th centuries. Today, I'm privileged to be joined by Dr. Ruben Loughman, Senior Lecturer in African History at Queen Mary University of London. His work highlights the agency of local people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and their responses to imperialism, war, and international development following formal decolonization in 1960. His research explores relations between local intermediaries, states, caterers, and international actors. He is interested in the spaces that Congolese people carved out over and above authoritarian rule, and how these spaces affected patterns of development, governance, and violence. As well as publishing his research in academic forums, he has appeared on Al Jazeera, Actualite.cd, Power FM, and RFI English. His recently published monograph, which was his first, titled Church, State, and Colonialism in Southeastern Congo, 1890-1962, was shortlisted for the EHS Prize in 2020, and incidentally, is the topic of our discussion today. I'm so pleased to be here today with Dr. Ruben Loughman. Thanks so much for joining us on our EHS podcast, Ruben.
Thank you. It's my pleasure and privilege to be here.
Yes, of course. Well, so let's just start with a contextual question. I mean, can you tell us a bit about the Southeast Congo in the late 19th century, perhaps a bit about the political situation before the Europeans arrived?
So the situation in southeastern Congo, and particularly the area that I examine, is what is now the province of Tanganyika. And this is northern Katanga, or the former Katanga province, and the north of that province. And this was a region that was convulsed in a range of different political movements and peoples. And so I want to spend a bit of time surveying these, but I'll do so as quickly as I can. One of the most important intrusions into this area was by Zanzibari merchant slavers. That is to say, they came from the archipelago of Zanzibar in the Indian Ocean, and they were very interested in raiding for ivory and slaves. And they were primarily led, particularly in eastern Congo, by Tipu Tip, who was somebody who probably never actually went to the Tanganyika province, and if he did, it was only very briefly. However, his family, or his extended family, actually did spend a lot of time there. And one of the most important protagonists in this regard was Abed bin Salam el Kaduri, who was known as Abedi. And Abedi spent some time in the region, the territory that I study, which is Congolo. And from Sola, his position in Congolo, Sola being a small town in that territory, Abedi actually interfered with local chieftainship and made it far more hierarchical. So the Zanzibari traders were very important because they interfered with chieftainship and they made it far more arbitrary than it was beforehand. So that's to say, they installed their proxies, and these proxies were called sultani. And the sultani would help, for example, Abedi raid for slaves and ivory. They would deliver these slaves to Abedi, who would in turn take them to a fort or a boma, and these would be somewhere further north, for example, in Kasongo, and they would then be sold. So the Zanzibaris were very important political actors during the mid-19th century and even beyond, and they fundamentally, as I say, changed a number of the structures of chieftainship in this part of the Congo. There were a number of other, for example, ethnic groups that the Zanzibari came into contact with, and they included, for example, most auspiciously, the Hemba group. And now the Hemba have a very complex past, and they're related to the Luba of Katanga. So the Luba of Katanga are another identity and form different polities in Kongolo, the territory where this book is based as well. The Hemba were often decentralized, so they had chiefs, but they weren't under the aegis of a paramount chief like the Luba Katanga were, and they often formed matriarchal groups. And so they were one group, and they operated particularly in the eastern part of Kongolo, and they came into contact, as I've said, with Abedi, who made their chieftainships far more arbitrary and far more centralized than they had been, or at least he did that with some of them. As I've suggested, there are the Luba Katanga. The Luba Katanga were far more centralized because they had a notion of kingship, and in particular, they had a notion of a fire king. Now, the fire king was somebody who had seen the Molopwe, the Luba king, eat, and so knew that he was a human, and it typically was a he. And the fire king would carry embers, like an emissary of Luba culture, to other parts of, for example, southeastern Congo. So a fire king called Buki was very important, in particular in southwestern Kongolo. And so Buki encountered the Zanzibari and had relations with them in terms of delivering ivory and slaves to them, but he kept his own independence to a large extent. There were also Songhe groups who again had cultural interactions with the Luba, and they have another history of their own right, but they were very, very intertwined with Luba history, particularly in Kongolo. So those are the main groups, and as I say, the dominant group, particularly as we get to the end of the 19th century, were the Zanzibari slavers, who, as I suggested, were making the institution of chieftainship, be it under a Hemba chief or be it under a fire king, they're making that chieftainship institution far more hierarchical and arbitrary.
And continuing along the timeline then, can you tell us a bit about the Belgian colonization of the Congo?
Absolutely. So the colonization of the Congo really starts with the King Leopold II of Belgium. So Leopold II ascends to the throne in 1865. He's very keen for Belgium to have its own colonies in order to increase prestige, but he's far more interested as a king in trying to set up a separate stream of income for himself so that he's not so dependent on Parliament for his purse. And he looks very much back to the kings of the past and their absolutism rather than constitutional monarchy, that constitutional monarchism was very much the order of the day, and he resents this. So in many ways, he's a very reactionary figure, and he's looking for a colonial territory or a fiefdom indeed to ensure that he has monetary fiscal independence from Parliament. And he searches across the world for this colony, and after reading Henry Morton Stanley's writings, he is convinced that Central Africa might be the right place to establish such a colony. So he establishes a number of front organizations, not least the International African Association. And he does this within, again, in the late 19th century. And because of these front organizations were loaded with rhetoric about philanthropy and the end of slavery, they caught on among the international community. And he would later hire Stanley to try to establish physical presence of his International African Association in Central Africa. And so in many ways, the activities of Stanley reveal the fact that the International Association was a front. In my project, we go later than Stanley's trip to Congo. We go into the 1890s, because by that point, King Leopold had legally annexed a large proportion of the Congo after the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 85, because of this rhetoric of philanthropy and abolitionism that he pro-offered the international community. And so he was able to annex the Congo under international law, and he called it the Congo Free State. The free part has a number of interpretations. One of them was that he wanted to say that there'd be free trade, that unlike how he portrayed Portugal to be, there would be free trade across Central Africa under his stewardship, as well as it would be free from the Belgian Parliament. So various historians have different interpretations. But fundamentally, the Congo Free State was an infamous, bloody monstrosity because of the atrocities that it carried out. Now, for my purposes, Leopold the Second and the International African Association, and later the Congo Free State, employed a number of militaristic individuals, such as Emile Storms, who worked for the International African Association, and in fact was key in establishing a base or a BOMA in the Congo Free State, or what would become the Congo Free State, in the early 1880s. And it was Emile Storms who erected a BOMA in Mpala, which is very close to the Congolo territory, or relatively close to it, and that would be one of the first European colonial forts that would actually start to indicate there would be a presence in the hinterland. And from Mpala, there would be militaristic expeditions launched, and Francis Darnis later on was key in conquering many of those BOMA that I talked about at the beginning of this podcast, the BOMA that were made by the Zanzibari. So, for example, in 1892, he took part in, for example, sacking Nyangwe, Kasongo and Kabambari, awarded the title of Baron in 1895. So that was the way in which Congolo kind of intersected with colonialism, that it wasn't part of the red rubber regime that was so preponderant in Western Congo, but it was more subject to a series of conflicts between the International African Association and thenceforth the Congo Free State and the Zanzibari traders, again, that I started this podcast talking about. So that was how Congolo came into the aegis of the Congo Free State. So there was considerable violence, but it was violence that was mainly orientated elsewhere, for example, further north towards those Zanzibari BOMAs, and rather than Congolo, which was in many ways relatively peripheral to the center of Zanzibari power, such as Kasongo.
Thank you. That's a very helpful context of the situation in your period. Let's move on to one of the central arguments that you're making in your monograph, which you raise as being the relationship between the church and the colonial state in the Belgian Congo. I wonder if you could tell us sort of a bit about the historiography. What do other scholars say about the relationship between the church and the colonial state? And importantly, what is your argument in this monograph?
So there's a rich historiography between the church and the state in the Congo. And I think we start in the modern sense, although there is historiography before Crawford Young. But Crawford Young, in the modern sense, has exerted a very important influence in his book Politics in Congo, just published by Princeton University Press in 1965. And in that book, Crawford Young uses the word seamless to describe the relationship between the Belgian colonial administration and the Catholic Church. And what I argue in my book is that he projected a relationship that he saw in the late colonial state back through time to, for example, the interwar period and even before then. So Crawford Young really starts the conversation by talking about a seamless relationship. Now, this was picked up later on by a number of scholars, and Marvin Markovits made the most important intervention in his book Cross and Sword. Now, Marvin Markovits actually exposed some of the very important fissures in the church-state relationship, but he concentrated mainly, though not exclusively, on the metropolitan angle of this relationship. So, for example, he looked at the Catholic Church and its lobbying campaigns within Brussels and within the halls of power in the Ministry of the Colonies, for example, as well as the Parliament. And he said that, yes, there were very important schisms, and pointed, for example, to the school wars in the very late colonial period as a very crucial example of a falling out between the church and the state. So Marvin Markovits really was one of the first scholars to raise significant questions about this church-state relationship, and particularly to historicize it over the period of Belgian rule. So I'm very influenced by Markovits's work. And likewise, other scholars had mentioned the church-state relationship, such as Bruce Fetter, and have talked about it coalescing, for example, in the 1930s. So a number of scholars had, for example, problematized the church-state relationship, and really, although they didn't explicitly say so, they actually questioned this seamless model, if only implicitly. So what I wanted to do is to take up the challenge of this writing, and to essentially to look at this through the local lens. Now, this had been done to some extent by A.M. Deluthi, for example, in his Missy and Stad book, but that looked at the Congo in 1880 to 1914. So he did do a local study in his book, but in fact, he only ended at the start of the First World War. So what I wanted to do was to look at the church-state relationship in a local context throughout the colonial period. I think that's the main contribution of the book, that it goes the entire length of the colonial period, and it's a local case study. And my argument, really following Markowitz, is that there are very important fissures in this relationship, and there are locally based fissures in the relationship, even if, for example, in the late colonial period, the church and the state work far more closely together for reasons that I go into, not least the fact that the church can help in the state's developmental programs, such as, for example, its agricultural innovations, or at least its agricultural program.
So you've noted there are some very important fissures in this relationship. Could you talk a bit more about these or identify some of the most significant ones?
The first point is that the church, and particularly La Vigerie, sees the development of a theocracy, a kingdom, a Christian kingdom in Central Africa, as one of his most important projects. And he sees, this is La Vigerie, the founder of the White Fathers Catholic Society, that Christian kingdoms are an important way of establishing what he deems as civilization in the world. So he saw the evolution of Christian kingdoms in Europe as a key means by which civilization emerged, particularly Christian civilization emerged in Europe, and he saw a similar model as potentially working in Africa. So he wanted to establish a Christian kingdom in what became the Congo Free State. So right off the bat, if you like, there is a conflict, because of course King Leopold wants the Congo Free State to be entirely under his writ, and he wants to be able to do with it as he pleases, whether that's to dispense with it in terms of concessions or whether that's to own outright, such as he did in the Crown Domain. He wants to be able to govern it really autocratically, versus La Vigerie, who wants a Christian kingdom and he wants perfect Christian communities. So there's a tension almost at the very outset of this relationship in southeastern Congo. And of course, this tension is finally resolved when, in fact, the White Fathers in particular are given a lot of power in this region. Storms does have to leave Impala, or at least the White Fathers take over much of this. And therefore, of course, you have this tension straight off the bat. But I wanted to talk more in detail about the things afterwards, the fissures afterwards, where you have, for example, the state having a very minimal presence in the very early colonial period versus the church having a great deal of presence. And that presence is signified in the construction of a great infrastructure, such as what were called school chapels, which would confine Africans to a complex that would be very difficult for them to leave, and that would cut them off from their traditional cultures. And so the state is often happy to allow this to happen because it wants very, very low-priced education, but it's also unhappy because the church starts to exercise its own canon law within the confines of these school chapel complexes. And therefore, there are very serious arguments, and in particular, I point to one in the book where Emilio Kellyworth, this is of the Holy Ghost Fathers, the Spiritans, Catholic missionaries, Emil Kallio actually whips someone with a hippopotamus hide whip outside the territorial bureau because he suspects this person of adultery. And now, this is not following colonial law, and the territorial official concerned is very upset because it's a flagrant disregard of colonial law. But he, in effect, shrugs his shoulders. There's nothing he can do to discipline Kallio. He sees the father as completely unassailable, and so he allows this to happen. So the church actually practices its own legal code in full view of the state, which often doesn't like it and yet can do nothing about it. So I think the 1920s were a very big example where you have the establishment of a strong and institutionally powerful church versus a very weak state. If we continue, the construction of colonial chieftainship is another prime area of concern that I point to in my book, and I look at the chieftainship of Risazi Katori as well as Kalamba Sindano on the east. These are Hemba chiefs, and the state sees these as its new men. They are numerate, they're literate, they've worked as clerks, or at least they've had employment within the European community, if not the colonial state itself. So the colonial state sees them as our perfect candidates to rule what it believes are unruly areas. And yet they practice witchcraft. And while the state is happy, I think, to turn a blind eye, missionaries protest. They are very, very upset by this practice of witchcraft and the brutality that it entails. And so they lobby the colonial state, which eventually dethrones them and places them into internal exile, which in the colonial parlance is called relégation. So this relégation of two previously very loyal colonial subjects was something I think that is another example of a fissure between the church and the state. And I think in the end, something I point to at the very end of the book was a fissure about should the state or should the church go? The state was asking the church to go, particularly the secessionist Katangi state, that so the church wasn't safe and the church decided to stay. That the church increasingly didn't identify as part of the colonial state, not least because in 1956, Auguste Brisseret, the minister of the colonies, wanted more secular education. The church starts to pull away from the state and the church identifies far more as a different institution, and it stays, albeit under great danger. And of course, that danger is manifested in the end of the book when many Spiritan missionaries are killed by militants, I think, of Balu Bakat origin, although this has never been proved. So the church identifies as a different institution in the end, despite the fact that colonialism was a key part of its evolution in the Congo context.
You've expanded upon that a bit practically in your previous answer, but I wonder if you could talk a bit more about your research looking through this local lens, how you examined this church relationship this way, and indeed why it's significant to do so.
Yes, I think precisely because I see there's often a disparity between what policymakers want and the legal writ and decrees of the colonial state and what actually happens. So it's that disparity between policy and practice that interests me. But also I wanted to see what this meant on the ground, as it were. What does this mean to people's lives? And I didn't get that sense a lot from the pre-existing literature that, OK, the church and the state may have disagreements in Brussels, but what does that mean to some of the protagonists in my book? For example, Ihuna Marcel, what does it mean to people like Kalonda Silvestre? So I wanted to see what these disputes meant, how they impacted upon the lives of those who lived under the writ of Belgian rule during this time. So that was why I wanted to look at it from a local lens, because I wanted to be able to trace individual life histories and how disputes between the state and the church impacted upon them.
And looking at relationships like this, the relationship between church and state in colonial Belgium, how did you tackle the power balance in this research? Did you see the church as hegemonic, and did the indigenous groups demonstrate agency?
This is a very important question, which I deal with in the introduction. I'm fairly unfashionable in a number of respects. The first point is the church, I believe, did have the aspiration of hegemony. It wanted to colonize the consciousness of the people who entered into the school chapel complexes that I've talked about. So it certainly had that ambition, but it did not succeed, or at least if it succeeded, its success was only marginal. And the reason was that if you look through the mission diaries, which are key sources to my book, that they run all the way through, and they are some of the most continuous sources available, which do flesh out some life histories. But if you look at the mission diaries, they constantly talk about the frustrations of missionaries in imposing the very strict discipline system in the school chapel complexes. So you have people absenting themselves without leave. You have people who may be baptized. They may actually attend school, but then they will, in the minds of the missionaries, the European missionaries who presided over these school chapel complexes, they go back to their old ways, if you like. So they aren't necessarily the pure Christian converts that the Catholic missionaries are looking for. So in terms of agency, what I see is that there is a lot of it, although it's often not the agency of outright rebellion and revolution. It's often the agency of appropriation. That is to say that Africans often, in my understanding, certainly from the archives, are very interested in education and very interested in healthcare. What they're not so interested in is being completely subject to the discipline of the school chapel complex. So there are a number, particularly in the late colonial period, of pupils in mission schools, for example, in Sola and some of the primary schools, and later some of the secondary schools. But they are not all, or they don't all become priests, they don't all become converts. Many of them leave, many of them take up positions, not least within the Great Lakes Rail Company, which is a very important secular employer, if I can use that problematic term. But I think in many ways, this is a very industrial employer, and the missionaries look at it with a great degree of suspicion, that people go to the Great Lakes Railway workers' camps and they earn a lot of money and they're not so interested in attending mission classes anymore. And certainly during the 1920s and later during the late 1940s and early 50s, when times are good, this is what happens. And of course, when the Depression strikes, this means that missionaries have arguably more success, because there are fewer jobs, fewer contracts to go around in institutions like the Great Lakes Rail Company or the mineral holdings further south, the mineral industries such as the Mineral Union of Upper Katanga, the Union Minière de Katanga. So in many ways, what you see is a historical oscillation between those times when the economy is doing well and there is a lot of labour migrancy, and those times where you have depression and you have, for example, lots of people going back to the village and back into the outstations.
Let's take a step back and look more broadly at your research for this monograph. What sources and methodology have you used in this research?
Well, as I mentioned at the opening, or at least part of the introduction, that the sources that were absolutely fundamental were the mission diaries, and they haven't been looked at, I believe, in as much detail as they could have been, because they are tremendous resources. Not only do they give some of the more private thinking of the missionaries away, but they often go all through the colonial period. So these are some of the only sources that there are very few gaps that I found. They stretch from the time when the White Fathers and the Spiritans arrive in 1909, all the way, actually, in some cases, to 1962. There will be the odd gap, but generally you have a daily entry, on pain of sin, in fact, throughout the colonial period. So they form the backbone of this monograph, because they are some of the most continuous sources. They sometimes deliver gold in the sense of the witch-finding instance, an episode that I talked about in the 1930s in the chieftainships of Benamambwe and Benanyembo. Sometimes they don't deliver the goods as such to the historian, that they're very cursory. They tell only the most basic details about logistical movements, but they do form, as I say, the backbone of this book. And there are various intricacies and methodological quirks I can get into, if you'd like me to, about these mission diaries. So they form the backbone. Also, the annual reports of both orders, both mission groups, the Spiritans and the White Fathers. So they write published reports. Now, the published reports obviously are more problematic sources to some degree, in the sense that they are meant for external consumption. So they have to be read with a great deal of care. Of course, all sources have to be read with care, but they are for external consumption. So they will often put a veneer of triumphalism on the proceedings. And that needs to be tempered somewhat with reference to the private diaries that I talked about at the beginning. But they are very useful because they give you statistics, at least the statistics the church wanted an external audience to understand. And they often give a broad overview of some of the dynamics which are affecting the individual stations writing about these, or writing these diaries. So mission reports, mission diaries were crucial, of course, mission correspondence when available. And then, of course, one turns to the colonial archives in Brussels. Now, these were very good in some periods and absent in others. For some reason, there are very few reports from the territory of Congolo after 1954. 1954 represents something of a cutoff. And I asked the archivists this, and there wasn't an answer forthcoming. And I'd ask if there are any colonial historians or historians of Belgian Congo there, if they know why 1954 marks this date, I'd be intrigued. But from around the period of the early 1920s to 1954, the colonial archives have annual reports, and these reports tell of the colonial state's thinking about what's happening in Congolo. So again, these are difficult sources because they tend to euphemize violence or completely whitewash it. They don't talk in great detail about some of the failures of the colonial project, because the territorial administrator wants to present a good report of what they have been doing that year. So there are problems, but they also contain statistics, and they also make a historian able to peer into the official mind to some degree. And to some extent, I used industrial sources from the Great Lakes Rail Company, although they tended to be from the later colonial period than the period of, for example, the First World War and after the interwar period. So those were the collection of archival sources that I was primarily interested in. And then, of course, there was oral history, life history interviews, which were crucial, not least in fleshing out the later parts of this book, for example, the last two substantive chapters. And they were fantastic because, of course, life histories often disappear from the archives that I've talked about thus far. And they were some of the most interesting sources. And I think that they made those chapters far more engaging to some degree to write because there were personal histories attached to them. And I could follow individual histories through. So that was very interesting. And so oral history also forms a very important part of this project.
These oral histories, were these interviews that you conducted yourself, or were you procuring them from archives?
I conducted them myself. I had a friend with me. I worked with a few people, but I think my friend Juvenal was fantastic in this. I don't know what it was, but I think he spoke French and Swahili in an accent that really I could understand very well in a very clear way. And so when he translated, for example, from the Hemba or from the Luba, I think predominantly from the Hemba, and even from the Swahili, I could really understand him very, very well. Whereas French, I've always struggled with a little bit, to be honest, in the sense that I didn't study a lot of French at university. And so I learnt my French mainly doing archival work in Belgium and also on the spot in the Congo. So I had Juvenal with me, and he was fundamental in translating from, at times, the Swahili, but certainly from the Hemba. And so that was very important. And lots of people in Congolo speak Swahili. And of course, that's their second language in some cases. So there are issues of translation. And so I was hearing everything, if not in Hemba, then certainly in Swahili. So one of the areas that I'd love to do more about is Luba, and the Luba Katanga language would be a great thing for me to understand more of, frankly. But Swahili was the main working language, as was French. So I conducted these interviews myself. It's a very long way of saying I conducted these interviews myself with Juvenal predominantly, and with a range of different people in Congolo, with the, I suppose, survey population being constituted first of those who wanted to be interviewed, but second, those who were available. Obviously, lots of people have died, not least as a result of the recent conflicts in Congolo and the Congo more broadly, but also because the colonial period is quite far away.
That's so interesting, especially for historians like me, whose periods are just too far back in the past to obviously be able to interview anybody who would still have living memory of what occurred. I think you've kind of already answered this, but how did you go about finding interviewees then?
Really, what I used, what I think has been informally described as a snowball technique. So what I would do, and I think I really struggled at the first out at the outset, because I arrived in 2008, and essentially I was staying in the seminary in Congolo, and I was quite scared to go out, and I interviewed lots of the priests that were there because they were passing through. But my research wasn't very successful because I was interviewing priests oftentimes who had no memory of the colonial period, but had heard things and they wanted to talk to me about what they had heard from, for example, people that had experienced the colonial period, or their thoughts about what they thought the history was. So it was very difficult, and I didn't really succeed very much until I met Juvenal, really. That Juvenal was fundamental, and he worked in the Caritas Bureau, which was, as you know, is a very important part of the Catholic Church's developmental initiative. And he worked there, and when I met him, he was able to take me around Congolo, and we talked to a number of people, because I said, I want to talk to people who remember the colonial period. And so once I met Juvenal, he put me in touch with a range of people that he knew, and it went from there. So I'd ask the people, do you know, and that's one of my main interview questions, do you know somebody who could tell me about the colonial period? I think that was one of the questions that I asked most of all. And that way it built up, and the contact built up. And then finally, I managed to speak to quite a few people, actually. And I was surprised at how many people I was able to speak to, because I thought, because I went in 2008 first, I had a number of visits, but 2008 was the first visit. We're talking quite some way after the colonial period, nearly 60 years. So I was very surprised, or 50 years, I should say. My math's not serving me very well. 50 years after the colonial period. So actually, I was very surprised there were so many people out there to speak to.
Absolutely fascinating. So moving a bit further into the realm of personal questions on your research, what inspired you to embark upon this arena of research?
Yeah, I think a range of things. Like, the first point was that I had a headmaster in primary school who was a graduate of the School of Oriental and African Studies and who had been to Kenya. And he told me, and the school in assemblies, the most fantastical stories about his life in Kenya. And at first I thought these are too fantastical to be believed, but it was all true. And he invited a couple of his South African friends to come, I believe, when I was in year six. And so I started talking with them about Africa. And then after having been, I suppose, converted to being an Africanist early on in that sense, I wanted to know whereabouts in Africa I should go. And when I read Heart of Darkness for my A-level literature, I then made up my mind that the Congo was the place. I wanted to know, as it were, the fact behind the fiction of the novella that Conrad published in 1899. So the Congo was where I wanted to study, and it was a long time before I could find somebody who could supervise such a dissertation in the UK. And in many cases, one of the things that's happened since I began my doctorate is that the field has flourished. There are now many experts on Congolese history in the UK. When I started, that wasn't the case. So in many ways, there's been a real positive flourishing of that kind of knowledge and research in the last 10 years, which is wonderful. But it was primarily my head teacher and Conrad who focused me on the Congo, and the availability of archives that focused my attention predominantly on the colonial period rather than that of the Congo Free State in the context of what's now the Tanganyika province.
And I think you've already preemptively struck for the next question, quite possibly, but maybe you could say a bit more. Why do you feel that this research is valuable or important?
Yes, I think the first point I'd make is that rural Congo is often left out of histories. In fact, rural Africa, whilst there is a lot of history on rural Africa, actually is, I feel, and this could just be a feeling rather than an actual statistically considered view, but the rural Africa, particularly rural Congo, is the poorer cousin of its urban counterpart. That urban studies, and the Congo, particularly Kinshasa, is studied by a number of scholars, and there's a lot of books about Kinshasa, relatively a lot about Lubumbashi too, less about Kisangani, interestingly, but there is a lot of studies about cities. So the first point about this literature is to open up a discussion about rural Congo. And I hope that scholars take up that challenge, that there is more scholarship about rural Congo. And the second point is really following on from that, is to try and understand more about how rural Congo works in the present, to encourage a dialogue about how, for example, Caritas works, how international aid works in the rural context in the Congo. Because again, I think that the discussion is often centered on cities such as Kinshasa. I think the third point is, of course, just a scholarly one, that I wanted to do a sustained local study throughout the entire colonial period, and that includes the late colonial period, that there are a number of books concentrated on, for example, the Free State, the early colonial period, the late colonial states, the poorer cousin of that scholarship. And so I wanted to emphasize that. And I think finally, I wanted to bring attention to this area of the Congo, because it's not really got that much before. It's often very, very marginal to histories. And so I wanted, again, I hope to open up a discussion about this part of the Congo and to try and understand it in greater detail. And I suppose what the periphery of, for example, the state, as well as the cultures of various ethnic groups like the Lube Katanga, what the peripheries can reveal, I think, is quite profound, and not least about the limitations of power, as well as the negotiation of identity when values are laid bare on the frontier.
Thank you. Before I let you go, Ruben, I wonder if you can tell us if you're working on any other projects at the moment, or indeed what's next for you?
Thank you very much. So what I want to do are a number of things. I think the first point was, when I was researching this book, one thing that struck me was there is a lot of architecture about or from the colonial period. And this was fascinating. And so what I hope to do some more work on is to look at the ways in which this architecture first was formed, but second, how it plays a part in the contemporary history of the Congo. So that's the first point. The second point is to look at the Protestant side of the equation, because, of course, I've looked in detail at the Catholics. What I want to do is to look particularly at the American Protestant organizations that were operating in the Congo throughout the colonial period. Because while scholars have used the sources that they have made, there hasn't been a systematic study of American Protestants in the Congo. So that's something I would like to do. And the sources are tremendous. There is a huge reserve, for example, at the Presbyterian Historical Society archives in Philadelphia, much as the Methodist archives in Drew University. So there are a number of archives that I think haven't actually been used as much as they could have been, which I intend to use. And so that's the main project I think that I'm going to be working on for the next maybe even half a decade of my scholarly career, is looking at American Protestants and their relationship to not just the Belgian colonial state, but of course the groups that they work with, the African ethnicities that they work with in the Congo. So that's the main, I'd say, project that I'll be working with in the immediate future.
Thank you. We may have to have you come back to do another EHS podcast episode in the future, once you are further along with that particular avenue of research as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating. Before I let you go, might you like to end our podcast episode by telling our listeners once again the title of your monograph and where they might procure a copy for themselves?
Thank you very much. So my monograph is Church, State and Colonialism in Southeastern Congo, 1890 to 1962. It's available through Palgrave Macmillan, as well as in all good online retailers such as Amazon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ecclesiastical History Society podcast. Stay tuned for our next podcast episode, which will be advertised on our social media pages. If you're not currently a member of EHS, we highly recommend you consider doing so. It's a great opportunity to network with other like-minded historians and keep abreast of latest research in the field. More information is on our website, ecclesiasticalhistorysociety.com.